Welcome to the Creative South Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Frostholm. Today I talk with Sed Funches, Executive Director of Design at Vox Media. We talk about how his mom getting cancer helped him focus on family, ending up homeless for a brief period of time, dealing with depression, and how his wife helped him through that period of life, and more, all right after this. We all secretly, and some of us openly, know that we have a deep love for stickers. Whenever we go to Creative South, we come home with a massive sticker haul and we feel like kids again. But why do we have to wait another year for this feeling? Luckily, Slaptastic can give you that feeling each and every month, direct to your mailboxes. Each month, you receive a pack of 6 limited edition themed stickers that you can enjoy and share with your friends and family. Head on over to www.slaptastic.com/CS17 and sign up today with a special offer just for you. We've gone through and streamlined the Creative South Podcast Patreon page, cleaning out the excess and making it easier for you to support us. With options starting at just $1 per month, you can help support the podcast and even wind up with some cool Creative South Podcast swag. Every dollar helps cover hosting costs, upgrade equipment, and keep the podcast going. When you become a Creative South patron, you'll get access to exciting Creative South news before anyone else, Creative South podcast stickers and t-shirts. So, please help support the podcast and become a patron over at patreon.com/creativesouth. Sed, thanks for joining me tonight.
Not a problem. I'm excited to be on here talking with you.
Yeah, I didn't know whether to call it tonight or this afternoon. I'm still getting used to the time change.
I know. You know, the worst part, I lived in San Diego before we moved to D.C. Mm-hmm. And I can honestly say the worst part of the time change is watching late night basketball at like 11 o'clock.
Oh, yeah.
The games don't come on until 10:30, 11. Uh-huh. If I make it through the first quarter, I'm doing something for myself. So another hour of sleep. Do we get more hours of sleep?
No, I think we lose an hour with this one. Yeah, because when you get up in the morning, your body's going to feel like it's an hour earlier than it was.
We'll make it through. I think we'll survive, Jason.
Yeah, I hope so.
Right on.
Cool. So let's kick it off. Where'd you grow up?
I'm originally from Minnesota. I grew up in St.
Paul.
I grew up in St. Paul.
I grew up in Chaska.
Get out of here.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. I lived there till I was 13.
Wow. That's what's up. Yeah, I was born and raised in Minnesota.
Okay.
Yeah, went to St. Paul Central. Mm-hmm. All of the magnet and junior high schools in the St. Paul area. Graduated in 1996. So I'm a true St. Paul, Minnesota kid.
Yeah. So you're only a few years younger than me.
Yes.
I graduated.
If I knew how old you were, I would.
41.
Say yes.
I graduated in 93.
Oh, right on. Yep. I'm 38.
Yeah.
Yes.
So,
<Get up there.
laughs> only a couple of years till 40.
I know. I'm hanging on in there. But St. Paul, well, you know Minnesota. So, mm-hmm. Used to cold weather, used to like bitter freezing temperatures. And but, you know, the beautiful part about Minnesota that I think a lot of people don't get to see if you're not from there is, mm-hmm. the seasons changing are actually really great.
Yeah.
Being able to do different things in different parts of the seasons. That's really what I loved about Minnesota.
Yeah.
It was hunting and fishing, or even just knowing what sports you're playing because, mm-hmm. the seasons would change. Grew up in St. Paul, Minnesota. That's it.
Gotcha. So when you were growing up, were you an arty kid or were you more into sports?
I always had the ability to draw. Like I could draw anything by the time that I was in the third or fourth grade. You know, I could truly just look at something and draw it. And I think my parents pushed me into doing it a little bit more than what I wanted to do. You know, I love sports and love playing. All of my friends play sports. So I think it was kind of a mixture. I had the ability to do it. it wasn't anything that I wanted to do religiously. So
sure.
I think it's just something that kind of came along. I think by the time I got into the fifth and sixth grade, I had too many teachers who were making sure that I wasn't playing sports and doing more art, you know? So it was kind of cool, you know, just growing up. But yeah, I was a regular kid just growing up. I played a lot of sports when I was growing up. So I think I was more into sports, more into team activities than drawing. I always felt like drawing and painting was kind of, I felt isolated a little bit. You know, I'm kind of a people's person, so I like to be around a lot of people and laughing and joking. And
sure.
My parents wanted me to draw, like, oh, you have to practice. And I'm like, it's too much work. Way too much work.
So when you get through with high school and all, what do? Do you go to college? Do you jump out there, start working right away?
Actually, you know what? I went to art school. I went to the Art Institute, Minnesota, and I learned absolutely nothing there. You know, graphic design, I mean, at the time, the cool part is being in Minnesota, like Minneapolis is kind of a mecca for graphic designers and,
yeah,
you know, agencies and things like that. So I was always close to individuals who kind of had that pedigree. But, you know, I went to school and didn't really think too much about my career at that time. You know, my whole plan was just to move to California and chill. Like that was my big idea when I was 17. I was like, oh, I'm just gonna move to San Diego. I had a friend in San Diego. I was like, we're gonna get a house and we're gonna split the rent. You know, that was my thing.
So, no thought on how you were gonna pay for that.
Though. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I had no idea on the realities of income and things like that. But yeah, I went to art school. Fortunately for me, I met a lot of people and I knew a lot of people in Minneapolis. Growing up. And one thing that I did get out of going to that art institute was it was still kind of early in, I guess, that college's history. So
sure.
A lot of professionals, you know, that was the thing, is we want to get professionals who are actually doing it to come and teach. And I actually had like some pretty good teachers, some who were working at Duffy and like really working at some top ad agencies. And one of the best advice, one of the, I think it was a counselor, he said, always do informational interviews. Like no matter what job it is.
Sure.
Just call up and find the person who you think their job is cool and you want to do what they do and just say, hey, you know what? I'd love to learn a little bit more about you. And would you be interested in an informational interview? I just come and tag along for a couple hours, see what you do. That was probably my ticket, because that got me from the college to some of those ad agencies and kind of shaping what I wanted to do. So after college, you know, I did do my thing. I went to San Diego and milled around for a little bit. Nothing too spectacular was accomplished. A lot of money wasted, a lot of hanging out on the beach. But my mother fell ill with cancer and I had to come back to Minnesota. And so fortunate for me, like I said, you know, making those connections, I had a few connections of individuals who were working at the Minnesota Timberwolves. So, you know, I went from not really knowing what I wanted to do to getting into a position where I could start talking to people who were doing something that I wanted to do in the graphic design world, and then ending up working for the T-Wolves.
Sure. So what were you doing for the Timberwolves?
I started off as a graphic designer and immediately moved into more of an art director role, because we had to work for the Timberwolves and the Lynx. So basically everything that you saw from 2000 to 2007, myself and I worked with a colleague of mine, Henry Moore, he's actually still there. We created it. We didn't have any interns or help or anything like that. We usually had just people saying, oh, you don't want to do your job? There's somebody else who wants to take your job. You know,
the great motivator of
the great motivator. tickets, season tickets, billboards, you know, everything that you possibly see. Even at that time, we were running print advertising. And so I got to do that. I had the privilege of doing that on a daily basis.
Sure.
Running print ads. So pretty much the gamut of design, and from a branding standpoint, that was really what my first exposure to that is, designing at scale at a high level for T-Wolves. So just about everything you see, you know, it's kind of surreal when I think back to it. You know, I was tired all the time, but you're a kid, so you don't really think of it. But, you know, basically everything that people would wear to the games and, you know, thunder sticks, you know, I had a hand in creating it. So it's pretty cool.
Gotcha. So how are you managing all of that? Because it's such a small team and that's a lot of output and a fairly large scale of something to do. How are you managing to stay on top of that?
I think it was fear. a lot of hours, man. Like, it was a brutal job. I think any job in the professional sports is, you do, you're considering putting a lot of hours and input output for that. But I think for me, you know, we were fortunate enough to work with a lot of good individuals who, you know, everyone who's in sports is trying to angle to get a little bit further along.
Sure.
So, you know, what we were able to do was forge good relationships with CSRs and some of the business individuals, business development leads. And that was truly how we kind of stayed ahead of the game, is we had good relationships with individuals. We were usually taking on projects that were sometimes a little after hours, but more along the lines of, this person needs these three things so that they don't have to come back and ask us again.
Okay.
And so between myself and Henry, you know, we had a flow manager and, you know, a few marketing managers, but hey man, you know, the lists are there and the work is there, and Cork Express and Illustrator need to be fired up. So let's go.
Yeah. I was about to say that is the Cork Express time. That's before pre InDesign.
Oh man. And I better have brought my zip disks. If I left them at home, I'll have to go back. I mean, it's such a crazy time to think back to how easy my job would have been now with technology now.
Sure.
Then, oh my gosh, I mean, I could have stayed home half the time. Just did work from home.
Yeah. So you mentioned your mom got sick. How did you handle that? Because I know you did something around that as well.
Yeah. You know, that was, I'll be honest with you, that was a very, I didn't realize it at the time, to be honest with you, Jason, how much it changed who I was as a person. I think, you know, before my mother got sick and I had to watch her kind of go through all of that, I don't think I was self-centered, but I truly was just focused on my own career and what I can get out of life and things like that. And
sure.
Having to work through that, that was probably one of the toughest things in my life. Financially, you know, a lot of the income that I had coming in had to go to my family and support my family. And, you know, it was tough. I can't even lie. There was a lot of times when, you know, I kind of fell into the ruts from design. And a lot of people are like, well, hey, how come you didn't get this done? And you want to go into explaining that, you know, your mom is kind of recovering from cancer. But at the same time, it's the NBA, so you can't really do it. I mean, you have a few people who knew and who were considerate, but there's a lot of people who were just like, yeah, whatever, dude. So I need it done. So I really think that was one of the more enlightening moments in my life, where I think a lot of my focus shifted, where I wasn't as serious about work and I wasn't as serious about responsibilities. I wasn't as serious about, you know, I have to make sure I get these things done. And that, I think, has propelled me to where I'm at now, because it really made me focus on what's important. And, you know, my relationship with my family and relationship with my mother, that really, I think it kind of focused me in a little bit.
Gotcha. So you're working for the Timberwolves. You're dealing with your mom being sick. What are your next steps after that? How do you move past that?
Yeah. I think I moved past it in probably the most piss poor way that imaginable. I went and got another full time gig.
Gotcha.
And see, I'm older now and I can look back on it, and the proper move would have been to maybe switch gears a little bit
mm-hmm.
slow down, process what you've been through. Because if you work in any professional sport, I mean, it is a grinding thing. And
yeah.
to kind of have some emotional weight on top of that, I probably, looking back, you know, hindsight being 20/20, I probably should have slowed down, but I didn't. I went full speed ahead, and I got a job as a director of creative marketing for a video game company. And so I drowned my depression in more work.
Sure.
And as I'm older now, I can look back and see the pitfalls of that.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, I can point to that I accomplished things and I got to meet more people and, you know, I expanded my career and I did all these things, but I could truly look and see, hey, I didn't deal with how I felt. I didn't deal with the emotional toll that working in the NBA, how much effort I put into that. Dealing with it just being over. I'd never really dealt with it. I'll be honest with you. I never dealt with what I perceived as just moving to another job. But
sure.
It was similar to somebody probably playing a sport. You know, you're always riding this high. You're mm-hmm. always doing all these things. And then it goes away. And so in my mind, I'm thinking I'm replacing it. But I see now, even 10, 12 years later, you can't replace something like that. And if I had to chance to do it all over again, I probably would have taken a year mm-hmm. off and just tried to recenter myself.
So, you know, going from MBA to video game designer, you know, working at that high level, high, fast pace, everything is on, you know, I needed it 3 days ago deadline,
right.
You know. And then also switching to a completely different industry.
Yeah.
What is that like?
It's exciting, to be honest. You know, just on first impression, it really is. I think at that time, I'm the type of personality where I need to have things be accomplished.
Uh-huh.
And so for me, I thought that was a great step. You know, I had much more control. I didn't necessarily have to talk to myriads of people because, you know, NBA is a 50 signatures on something
sure.
before it goes out. But I think underneath all of it, to be honest with you, it's just stress. It's stress. I wasn't married at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I was getting close to being married, but it was a lot of professional stress that no one prepped me for to identify.
Mm-hmm.
And so really underneath all of that, you know, it's stressful, but I think that is what motivated me to kind of keep going. And, you know, hey, I never talked to Nike before. Let's give them a call. I never talked to Xbox before. Let's give them a call. What difference does it make? You know, and I think, you know, that opportunity made it a lot easier for me. Still couldn't replace the NBA, but
sure.
It was close. Video games is just entirely its own beast.
Right.
I learned so much working in that industry on production, on, you know, first party to third party, just how intricate all of that really is. And I think, again, you know, that was my attempt to replace what I was doing with the Timberwolves or with the NBA. And, you know, did it work? A little bit. yeah, I got to do some cool stuff, but to this day, you know, a lot of people ask me, like, you know, what even compares to that? I'm like, nothing. Nothing really compares to it. What it did allow me to do, to be honest with you, it allowed me to slow down.
Mm-hmm.
Because I didn't have that you have to work day and night kind of pressure on me. So
sure.
It allowed me to slow down and think more creatively on things where I'm not rushing, where the NBA is basically an avalanche of stuff. So your creativity is just nonstop because you're within it. It's one topic. It's one subject. There's no if and buts about it. It's this is what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You're basically a team moving. With video games, you have a dev cycle. So there's a lot of time, actually, that I took to think things through, think strategic partnerships through, And so I think that honestly helped me get my mind away from that kind of fast pace recognition that the NBA gives you into more of a thoughtful design execution standpoint.
Gotcha. So you're processing all this. You're a design director there. You've got these long dev cycles. Walk me through the process of how that works.
Wow. Well, there was two parts to it. We had an internal dev team that was working on a game. And so part of my time was spent with them helping, you know, helping level designs and helping just basically the internal dev of that. The other side was the publishing side, which is a little bit faster of a dev cycle. So sometimes some of those smaller games get done within, 3 to 7 months. Uh-huh. And I was a part of the actual sales process. So, you know, we're meeting with independent developers. I worked with a colleague of mine who was the director of all of our, Tony was, I don't remember his title right now, but he handled all of the game development, worked with all of the licensees and different things like that. And so that's exactly who I worked with on formatting. What is the game going to be? Why should we pick it up? How do we rotate it into our actual long tail sales cycle? What does it look like? What is the GUI? Do they have competent artists? You know, and those are all the things that from a publishing standpoint, we kind of looked at and said, okay, what do we need to do to kind of get this game to be a success? And how do we fit this into a sales cycle? On the publishing side, I think that was a little bit easier.
Sure.
On the internal dev side, that's tough. I feel for any independent dev team on a video game that doesn't have like Activision money. Because, I mean, it's you have to carry all that overhead and you're just kind of grinding away on the game. The game didn't, you know, the internal game didn't necessarily come out. And by the time that I finished, you know, I had worked on over 50 titles on the publishing side. So, you know, whether it would be touching something quickly and basically getting it prepped just to be sold, or getting to sit down with the dev team, work with their artists, work with basically their writers, some of their storyboard artists to basically bring it to life. That's basically all that you have within that window of time. And then we have to let it go and let them actually build the game.
Gotcha. So when you do that handoff, do you just immediately jump into something else, or are you juggling? I mean, obviously you're juggling multiple things at once, because from a business standpoint, it doesn't make sense to put all your eggs in one basket and move forward. But you know, how does that tie in? I'm trying to think of the right question. How does that tie into real world experience? Because it's such a different environment than most people are used to working in.
It's
a very non-traditional way of design.
It really is. You know, after a while, I got used to the requirements from Nintendo, Xbox. Like, some of it was line order stuff. You know, you put it in and you know what you're going to get. And those were usually the games that didn't have a lot of budget to them. So, of course, no effort's going to really be put into those. But, you know, if as a publisher, you're going to put a million plus into the development. We were kind of juggling the games, to your point. You're kind of juggling all of that in your head at the exact same time. And so probably 3 to 4 games at a time, you know, that were in development. And the best part about that is most of the time they never came in at the exact same time.
Okay.
So, you know, you're almost from different phases. You know, you basically enter in at different phases, and if we didn't have the bandwidth, we would definitely let them know. But I had a pretty decent sized team at the time. Had a couple marketing managers, had some senior designers and some junior designers. So you know, we were able to handle a good little bit from that standpoint. I think for me, that was good because it, I like to think of multiple things at one time. I mean, I get bored, honestly, with just one project, just one thing. You know, I'd rather solve the problem and then come back to it and try and solve it a little bit more or work it a little bit more. So, you know, the way that some of the game development was scheduled really worked in my favor for that, to be honest with you.
Sure. So when you move on from the game company, what do you end up doing?
I was let go by the game company.
So when they asked you to move on.
When they asked you to move on. It was probably one of the funniest moments in my life. I was married by then. Uh-huh. And my wife, who was originally from California, she didn't care for Minnesota at all. She couldn't understand how people could live in a cold place. You know, just couldn't take it. So I remember calling her and saying, this was right when the recession hit. And I was like, you know, hey, they're making cutbacks and my job has been eliminated. I think I had the choice to do something on the internal side. I didn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't want to do it. And so I was like, well, I don't really want to do that. So they're like, yeah, well, there's the door. So I called my wife and, you know, I remember telling her, I was like, hey, you know, I got something to tell you. And I was like, you know, not so good news. And I was like, hey, you know, I got let go today, you know, kind of went through the particulars on severance and stuff. And she goes, she's like, so, is there any reason why we have to stay in Minnesota? And to this day, she's never said, oh, I'm sorry you lost your job or anything like that. She's just like, can we leave now? So after that, like, I think it was February 4th, we were out to California we were out there by the 28th.
We moved
to California. Yep. Sold everything in the house. You know, I had, I think, one freelance gig to kind of tie me over. And I think I got 3 months, 3 or 4 months severance or something like that, you know, but just basically made the move. We had been, my family, like I said, is originally from Minnesota. So we'd been with my family for a while. And it was like, let's roll. Let's get out of here. So we moved to California. After the video game kind of ended, came to an end, I moved to California, and we were homeless actually for a while.
Really?
For 1 month, I was homeless. Absolutely. That was, again, it's these moments. You know, a lot of designers ask me, like, what are those key moments like when you work and you created this, and like most of the moments that have shaped who I am as a designer and what I think of have nothing really to do with design. They're more of what are the emotional things that I've gone through that have made me have to take a step back. And being homeless, yeah, that was probably I was at my lowest point. I felt that I couldn't provide for my wife. I just, you know, I was just low. Didn't want to create anything. Didn't want to see a computer. Got through that. Got on our feet. And I ended up working for the University of San Diego.
Okay.
I was an administrator there. So, NBA, video games, higher education.
Gotcha. Well, let's go back to that being homeless. I realize you lost your job and you made the decision to move out there, but what are you doing in that time? Aside from hunting jobs, you know, like a sane person would do.
Right. You know, it was, to be honest with you, it was surreal how, you know, we were kind of in a just waited out type of a period, you know.
Sure.
Trying to make sure that I had enough funds to make things happen. To be honest with you, man, the most of my time was spent in deep depression.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I did. That's how I spent my free time. Lots of self-doubt. Lots of second guessing. For the very first time, what I created didn't matter.
Sure.
So it didn't matter if I created something cool. And I think at the time, like, Dribble was just starting to. And so, like, I was like, oh, I got to fill up my portfolio and I got to do all these things. And I just had zero energy. Losing my job affected me a lot more than I thought it would. And again, it's one of those things, it was done quickly.
What do you think? It was one of those things where, at the very least, your professional identity was tied up in that job. Do you think part of your personal identity to you was tied up in that job at the time?
I think so. I think being able to put my name on things, mm-hmm. put my stamp on things, say that I had something to do with it, I wasn't ready to let that go. And
sure.
I think just like with the NBA, I was ready to let that go, to be honest with you. You know, yeah. You do enough media guides, you're like, okay, that's enough. So there was a yin and a yang on that one. With the video game, that kind of came to a close, even though, you know, I worked there for 4 years. But I didn't have anything else. And I moved to a different state,
mm-hmm.
which I didn't know anybody. And so there wasn't really anything that I could say I created and get recognized for creating it. Not praised for it, but just recognized that, oh, he's the guy who did this. I didn't know at that time how much my personal identity was mixed in with my professional identity. And going through that, you know, kind of that experience of being homeless and, you know, trying to just make ends meet and find a place to live, I think that's really what got me out of my head of putting my professional identity with my personal identity.
Sure. So how do you end up processing that depression?
My wife was great. We did a lot of talking, a lot of therapy. I went to therapy for that because it was deep depression, man. This was right before I wrote the children's book for my mom, and I didn't have anything, you know. And when you don't really have things, those were some of the things that I needed to create. And so what I was doing was basically creating this world that could be taken away. And through therapy, what I learned for about myself is, you know, I needed to create something that was internal for me, that had nothing to do with anybody else, different motivations. People look on the outside in and they think that I'm motivated by different things, but what I had to do was basically reconstruct myself, that my identity has nothing to do with what I create. My identity is me, and through me is what gets created. And so, you know, I give a lot of praise to my wife. She stuck with me and kept me supportive, truly talked with me every day. Even if she didn't want to, you know, she talked with me, hey, you know what, it'll get better. You'll get a job. And sure enough, I did. You know, it was about a month and a half to 2 months later. So probably 3 months total without any kind of prospects that I did get a job. But I really talked to people about depression, and, you know, it's something I think a lot of people deal with daily. I've talked with a lot of people, and they tell me that as a designer, you know, there's so many things that get in your way, so many things that get you down, that, you know, you could fall into depression. And I can totally relate with people.
I've
been there.
Yeah.
It's tough.
I know the feeling. I suffer from it well.
Yeah. Well, we're both from Minnesota. And so, you know, when it turns cold, although I would love to be outside when it's cold. You know, so
yeah, I always enjoyed it. I had a nice big hill in my backyard.
Yeah, I love that. Down. So I would never really understand how people are like, what are you getting depressed for because it's cold? But yeah, I tell people all the time, like, it was at that moment of understanding what the things that got me down and knowing that they're not going to go away. You know, sometimes I still struggle with depression. I struggle with anxiety and things like that. But I was basically forced to have to deal with it, where I think if I was working, I wouldn't have dealt with it. I would have come up with another reason to, or another project, or let me do a side gig, you know, and never really had to deal with it. So being homeless, you know, I even write about it. It made me have to think about what I was doing for myself and what I was doing for other individuals, for other people, for my family, and separate all of that, where I think a lot of times when you get into a professional career, it's just all globs together. And you never really have time to process it out on, well, what am I doing for myself? I'm helping all these things. I'm creating all this stuff. But is any of it making me happy? Is any of it making me satisfied? And you know, unfortunately, I had to be homeless for me to have those self-reflecting moments.
Yeah, not the most ideal way to go through.
No. I think, like I said, I'm a little bit older now. I can take the time and kind of talk myself through those things. But yeah, that was my experience. And I love telling people that story because a lot of individuals, you know, kind of think in design you have to have this bravado and you have to tell people what to do and you have to bark orders and, you know, I believe it this to be this way. And really what I learned in that experience is that, you know, design is truly an expression. And it's an expression that can get honed. It's an expression that can get sharpened. It's an expression that really has the ability to be whatever you want it to be. Mm-hmm. But if you kind of take on these personalities that you believe you're supposed to have, you'll never get there. You just end up being typecast into one of these roles that you thought a designer should be.
Yeah. I think that's a good way to look at it. It's, yeah. If you, yeah. I don't have anything to add to that. That's that's a great way to look at it.
Yeah. Like I said, other ways I would suggest outside of being homeless to get to this level of enlightenment. But I'm glad I've gotten there, to be honest with you.
Good. So you're how does the whole being an administrator going from design? I mean, obviously, you know, you needed a job, so
right.
I'm sure part of it was taking what you could find, but
right. Yeah.
How does that play into things?
It didn't play well at all. It played well for like the first 30 days.
Oh,
like that was cool. And then the actual reality of higher education, the bureaucracy, politics, I always look at things with a different lens. I think, you know, I was only frustrated at the level of bureaucracy in higher education because I didn't know that it existed.
Sure.
As I worked in higher education, I realized that that's at every college. It's at every university.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, nothing gets done.
I can see that.
At universities. It's not because people don't want to do it. It's just the way that things are structured, the way that people, you know, hesitate on making decisions. And
it's a very risk-averse environment.
Very. Everything is risk-averse. And you can take vacation enough that you miss key dates and you would be the key person who has to basically sign off on things. So it'll never happen. That
is a brilliant tactic that I think I might want to use someday.
Isn't that awesome? Or like your you're friends with the dean or of all the colleges. And again, I never really got, you know, frustrated with the people who I worked with, but I think it was a learning experience for me because I'm in my mind I'm like, well, higher education, you know, you hear it, like people are like, oh, it's higher education, oh boy, you know, they're never gonna get anything accomplished on that. Mm-hmm. And then you live it and you're like, oh wow. So we are going to go to 38 meetings and talk about everything we talked about the last meeting because no one wants to make a decision. So it was a great experience. I mean, I'll be honest with you. It's everything that I've experienced in my life. It's a great experience because I'm learning at the exact same time that I'm doing it. I learned a lot about not only how big universities work, but just truly the design process of universities. And how to help bigger colleges see the importance of design. That's a big challenge.
Yeah.
It is big. It's a big challenge. But, you know, I enjoyed my time there. Made some great connections. Again, being taught at a very young age to make connections with individuals. Find people who are doing what you want to do and make friends with them or become friends with them. Make sure that they know what you want to do. And so I think, you know, my time at the University of San Diego was pretty fruitful for me. You know, I got what I wanted out of it. But at the end of the day, I was like, so we're going to need to accomplish something.
Yeah.
You know, I need something to get done.
Sure.
It's funny, too, because there are people who would love that kind of job, which is hide in your office and you work 10, 15 years, you know, doing the right thing and saying the right thing, and no one would even think twice about you.
I mean, I have days where I would like that type of job, but not as a career path, no.
I'm always shocked how long people work there. Like, wow, you've been there for 35 years?
I mean, good benefits. Yeah. Look at that.
Very true. Very true. I absolutely. And I have been fortunate to work at places that have fantastic benefits.
Yeah.
So I can't knock that at all. So
at what point do you write this children's book?
It was while I was working at for the University of San Diego. So 2011, you know, after my wife brought me back from the depths of depression.
Sure.
I promised my mom that I was going to write a children's book, you know, when I worked at the Timberwolves. You know, I said, hey, you know what? I took you for granted when she had, you know, went through her, recovering from cancer. I was like, I took you for granted. I'm going to write a book. Never happened. Never had the time. Or I never really made the time. And so in 2011, what I started, I actually have a nonprofit called the Mother's Month Movement. So my entire premise was, hey, let's take the month of November and let's have everybody praise moms for the entire month of November. And maybe I could get some of my friends to do something cool around that time. And the best part about it is I started drafting the book and I started sketching it out and I started calling people, telling them what I was doing. And that's really how I started writing the book, because people started telling me about their parents and their mom. And hey, I haven't talked to my mom in 10 years and it was over an argument. And I mean, the amount of people, friends that I grew up with, people I just didn't even know, just reached out. Hey, you know, it's great what you're doing. Mothers deserve it. That really propelled me to kind of get that book done. To be honest with you. That's what got me to where I was at with that book. So I wrote the book, illustrated it, found that I was not the best illustrator in the world. You know, you always think that you could do it all. You're like, sure. Oh man, I got this. So I didn't have it. So I found actually a fantastic illustrator to help me finish the book. I completed it, and I've been fortunate enough to grow up with some pretty accomplished friends now. So kind of told them what I was doing, and rest is history. Partnered up with Threadless. I did all of these things around it. And to this day, people ask me, like, why did you do it? And I never did any of it for money or for fame or anything like that. I just truly, truly took my mom for granted.
Mm-hmm.
She was almost taken away from me. And I wrote the book for her. And that was it. But the fact that it touched so many people, you know, really got me back, to be honest with you, where it's like, oh, where'd you get your mojo back? Like, the book is what got me back in that groove of creating and connecting with people and talking to people and stepping outside of my comfort zone. And, you know, I was talking to moms. I didn't have a kid. So I was just talking to moms all the time. They're like, I had some people like, oh, you should do one that's only about single moms and what single moms have to go through. And I'm like, I don't know. Maybe we might want to just keep it with moms in general. But it was really cool. And that was, you know, 2011 was, you know, probably, it was a really big year.
Right.
Big year for me professionally and mentally, because I met so many individuals. I met my current boss, Ted Irvine. He was writing a children's book, and so we met online just because we wrote children's books.
Okay.
That's it. I call him Irvine. It's Irvin. I always call him Irvine. You have to edit that out.
Oh, I'm leaving it in. Yeah. I'm going to send it to him, too.
Ask him tomorrow. Be like, is it Irvine or Irvin? Which one is it? But no, it was a really good – I think it was a really good way to reset myself from – you don't have to have this nonstop Hollywood profession to get the same type of feeling of creating and making people feel happy. Like, I mean, the emails that I got, I mean, some of them brought a tear to my eye just because there were people who I knew who, because I wrote the book, they started sharing things that I had no idea that they going through some of these things, you know, you lose track with people from fifth grade to sixth grade, and
sure.
they buy your book and they're like, hey man, you know, here's what I've been going through, and I really appreciate you doing something like this. So from a professional standpoint, I think that's what helped me restart that engine of just wanting to create.
Mm-hmm. So what made you want to start the nonprofit around it? Because, I mean, obviously you're writing a book. Generally, you know, that's not necessarily the next logical step to go with in there.
It wasn't. And it wasn't. You know what I really started the nonprofit for? Because to do the Threadless deal, I had to be a nonprofit.
Ah, okay.
Right? And so I was like, oh, shoot, I'll start this nonprofit. And so starting a nonprofit took a long time. So I got a nonprofit, but I didn't have it in time. So, as chance and would have it, I had to go find a nonprofit to benefit from my partnership with Threadless. And that was harder than I thought it would be. So I would call nonprofits, go, hey, you know what, having this partnership with Threadless and all the proceeds will go to your nonprofit. I mean, people just hang up the phone. Like, whatever, gatekeepers.
I'm trying to give you money.
Exactly. Whatever. I called, I'm not even going to put their name out there because it's, I think to this day, they regret the entire episode because later on Twitter, you know, oh, we should work together. It'd be great if we did X, Y, and Z. And I called them, and not only was it so perfect, it was about mothers, so the nonprofit was about moms. It was about appreciating your mothers, and the nonprofit was about making sure that moms get the good stuff. And it was a very famous person. And I mean, hang up, city, boom. After they give me a lecture on that, I don't understand how this works and blah, 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 blah. And so I just came across a nonprofit. It's called Cancer for College. And I said, okay, let me just give these guys a call. And I called them and told them what I wanted to do. And I was like, hey, you know, I just see the nonprofit. You guys are doing some really cool stuff around, you know, kids who are recovering from cancer, and you give them a scholarship and a way to get to college. And I just think that's a really cool thing. And they're like, yeah, we'll do it. And I'm like, sweet. And I'm talking with them. They're like, yeah, you know, it would be cool if we got Will Ferrell involved. And I'm like, what? In my mind, I'm like, yeah, that would be awesome. it was Craig Pollard. And he was like, yeah, you know, this is really cool. And sure enough, just so happened that he went to USC with Will Ferrell, and Will Ferrell was a really big supporter of it, and the rest is history on Threadless. You know, that partnership happened, and I think we raised close to $6,000for that charity just off of t-shirt sales. So that was, again, just bigger things that I think because I didn't do them for myself or just do them for my own self-interest, things worked out and just kind of multiplied. So I've kind of taken that lesson forward from a professional standpoint.
Gotcha. So you mentioned in that you met your boss through this process.
Yeah.
You know, when do you make the transition over to Vox?
That didn't happen for a while. I think I probably had our first conversations with Ted maybe 3 years ago. You know, we were talking about SB Nation and a lot of the different things that were going on with Vox and Chorus. And I didn't understand what Vox Media was.
Sure.
At all.
I'm still trying to wrap my head around it, and I've known about y'all for years.
I didn't get it. And I remember one time just asking him, I was like, so what is Vox Media? Like, I knew what SB Nation was. I loved SB Nation. I was like, I get that. And finally he broke it down to me. I was like, oh, that's a lot bigger than what I thought it was. So I think a few years passed, and, you know, we just kind of kept in touch, and the position opened up last year, and, you know, Ted is doing, you know, one of the hardest tasks out there, creating a design organization that helps a huge company across the board.
Sure.
And so because he was doing that, you know, he was like, hey, you know, there's a position on the brand identity team, you know, want to come and join? I was like, absolutely. Yeah, you'll help shape the brand identity for all the 8 brands that we got. So, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I like the sound of that. I can do that. And so that happened last year around August. I started with Vox Media.
Okay.
So it's been great.
So how is it? Because like you said, you have 8 brands and it's fairly large scale with a lot of moving pieces. Yes. How is it balancing all of that?
Ask me in a year. No, it's, you know, I'm learning every day. I'm making mistakes every day. But I think the approach that I've tried to bring to the brands is let's give the brands a soul. Mm-hmm. And that's fairly easy to do, is to identify what's not there and to start identifying what needs to be there. Keeping all of that rolling, I'm fortunate enough to have a fantastic team. Mm-hmm. And a lot of support. And so the onus is really on us to not only ask the right questions, but really start making informed opinions on mm-hmm. what the brands need. That's honestly the best way I can explain how we keep it rolling, is we make a decision and we say, you know what, to reach this type of an audience, you're going to need this type of approach. How do we kind of wrap that into a theme, and how do we keep rolling? I'm on my very first brand refresh with SB Nation. We just finished The Verge. Mm-hmm. And really within doing these things, you know, we're refreshing not only the brand identity, but the editorial. So, you know, short answer on how do we keep all of this stuff rolling, it's huge. I work with some tremendous people and have a very tremendous support network underneath it. And, you know, Vox is trying to grow from that standpoint of, hey, we already have these entities. We already have them. They exist. We already have, you know, loyal consumers and fans of these things. Now, mm-hmm. how do we make them have more cultural relevance and grow? And so I get to be on that fun ride of helping them find an identity, find a voice, find celebrities that maybe need to maybe speak to what we're trying to do. Mm-hmm. And we grow it from there.
So, you know, in the middle of all of this, you went and had a kid.
I know. I know.
And we were talking about this before you got on air, but I, you know, how are you balancing all of that? Because it's a fairly high stakes job you've got. Yes. And then, you know, having a kid is a dramatic shift in what your priorities are. How does that work out for you?
You know, Vox Media is actually, it's a fantastic place for families, you know, individuals who having kids is a very, very, very progressive family policy, spending time with your family. And I think for me, I didn't take enough time, to be honest with you, when my child was born. Mm-hmm. I didn't take enough time to just unplug. I think I unplugged for, you know, I think I was supposed to unplug for, maybe 32 days. I unplugged for 26 of them. Mm-hmm. And I wish I would have unplugged for the other 6. Mm-hmm. But I'm a pretty high octane person.
Sure.
Like I said, I'm up at 5 o'clock every day. And so for me, I finally have a reason to be tired.
Yeah.
And that's how I look at it with my child, is my son is, he gives me a reason to be tired now. And work, you know, it's strange, but you know, as I was explaining before, like the priorities of things that you thought were important start to mellow themselves out and drown themselves out when you have a child. Mm-hmm. And now to be honest with you, I am a much more visionary designer. You know, I have to rely on seeing it mm-hmm. instead of just thinking that I see it, because with a kid, you don't have a choice now. Now, you know, a lot of it almost has to be what you need.
Sure.
So I don't like the word visionary, like, oh, I'm a visionary. But I think it's, I'm a lot more vision driven, where it's what I think, it's what I've researched. How do I put that together? How do I balance that? And having a kid on the side actually is my reinforcement, where maybe sometimes I would, you know, skimp on some of the research. now I have somebody who I can look at and go, ah, you know what? Let me get this done so I can play with my kid.
Gotcha.
That's the best way I can explain it.
That's a great way to explain it. You know, we're kind of getting close to our time, so wrap it up real quick with, you know, moving forward, what's on the horizon for you?
Well, my immediate goals, one, be a great father.
Mm-hmm.
Two, be a fantastic husband. Three, be the best designer and mentor and motivator that I could be. Right? That's honestly where I'm trying to move myself now is, you know, how can I affect as many individuals as possible by relating what I'm doing, mm-hmm. and helping them, helping maybe some of my experience relate that to what they're going through. My immediate goals at Vox Media, truly create some of the most dominant media brands that people have seen. I bring a different approach to design that is pretty, you know, I base a lot of what I do is in inclusivity. And a lot of people think of it as like, oh, you just, you know, you're about diversity. And I try and correct people and say, yeah, diversity is important, but I care about money. I really do. And it makes zero sense to only market to one set of people.
That's sure.
Ridiculous. So I think that's what working in the NBA truly teaches you is, you know, you want everyone to come to the game. You want it to be sold out. And I think that in the long term has helped me to really see, okay, we need to appeal to all these different facets of individuals. So whether we're thinking of things from a concept stage, mm-hmm. or whether we're thematically putting things out there, how do we make sure that people are included in there? And I think that shocks people. They're like, oh, it's all about diversity. I'm like, oh, yeah. So it's about money, though. Like, if you can really bring people in, you could show the business value of it, which gives it to more people.
I think from a business standpoint, there's a difference between diversity and inclusivity. And yeah. You know, from a business standpoint, you want inclusivity. You want to touch as many people in as many facets as possible.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And you don't want to pigeonhole with one market because that it's the same thing of putting all your eggs in one basket.
It really is. And the only way to truly be inclusive is to be diverse.
Right.
You have to have enough of the people around you to go after all the people.
Right.
Because
I think a lot of businesses lately have taken diversity as meaning segments. And that's a different thing.
And in what way, when you mean as segments?
Like they want, you want to, they're looking at demographics exclusively in their diversity. So they're, you know, everything is being segmented out to different markets. Instead of looking at the markets as a whole and how do you submarket within those.
Exactly. Well, I hear exactly where you're coming from. And I think the folly of a lot of businesses is that they got used to a balance sheet with uh-huh. the strategy that they had.
Yes.
Then those balance sheets go lower and lower and you're like, oh, wow, we have to sell to more people or we have to do something, raise the prices. And when you don't have enough people around you to go, well, actually, all you have to do is this. Hey, mm-hmm. actually, if you just do this, that is the Achilles heel. And it's all over Twitter now. But, you know, you could see it on everybody's lips. It's not that individuals don't want to do it. It's just that they have never had a strategy on how to do it.
Yes. I would completely agree.
Never had to figure it out. So now it's like, oh, crap. Now we have to do all of these things when I really tell people, kind of don't.
Yeah.
You kind of don't. What you have to do is think of the entire group of individuals mm-hmm. and not segment it out to say, I need to sell it to you a certain way.
Right.
I just have to make it more accessible to you. If right. the way I'm giving it to you is not as accessible, even if it's from a media standpoint, if it's content, if it's how people read, you know, there's one conversation I was having with an individual on giving people book lists.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot. That's what designers love to do.
Like, yeah.
Here's my 10 books that I'm reading. What if a person can't read? What if a person doesn't want to read?
What if a person has a newborn and doesn't have time to read?
So there's all these factors where we believe, hey, we're giving you this nugget, but I have not made sure that that nugget was as accessible to you as possible.
Sure.
For someone who doesn't have time, if I gave you a book to read, but I said, you know what, you don't have the time. Let me give you the crib notes. This is what this is all about. Mm-hmm. That could be helpful to somebody. They could be like, hey, that's great. That's all I had time for. So from a design standpoint, you know, turning everything back into problem versus solution, it's how do you think of those things in advance? Because I think that's where a lot of designers fall flat, is they're not thinking of these things way before you start putting pixel to paper or pixel to pixel and going, hey, you know what? This is our answer and our solution.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you have to ask yourself, are you the best person for that solution? Have you even had that problem? I remember I put that on Twitter. Like, how can you solve a problem you've never had?
Yeah.
I mean, it just filled up. Well, you can try. Actually, you can't. This is real life. No one needs you to just try.
Because
no one asked you to just try. No one just came up to you and was like, hey, Jason, I wish you would just try to solve these problems. And I think design as an entire industry had a wake-up call a couple of years ago where people had to come headlong into that the designs and ideas you were working on and sweating on and discussing and arguing over and maybe having artificial arguments over don't work for everybody.
Right.
So how do we reverse that? That's really what, to be honest with you, my goals for the next 2 or 3 years is to join that conversation and help people understand. All you have to do is just stop for a second. Understand that I don't know enough about Jason's background or what he has to do tomorrow to offer up a solution. Let me find out. Let me get to know Jason. Let me meet his twin boys. Let me meet his wife. Let me meet somebody to give me the real lowdown on what's going on. What are your real needs are? I think as designers or just as people who create, we only go for surface value information. And so you're never getting down deep enough to be inclusive. Even if you want to be, you're not really understanding what people need. How hard to be inclusive if you don't really understand people?
Sure. I would completely agree.
Yeah. This is great. This is great. I just talk to you all the time. I got to bring you around with me and just go, what do you think, Jason? You're like, I agree with everything you just said.
I'm not a yes man.
No.
Just happy to agree with you on this.
Just happy to. All right. No, I got you. Well, this is great. I'm glad I am. I'll be honest with you. A lot of people talk about like what excites me as a designer or challenges or things like that. Like, you know, the biggest challenge is to get people to relax and just talk.
Yeah.
Just talk. We don't have to solve the world's problems. We don't have to do anything. I haven't even asked you what beer you're drinking.
What am I drinking? I'm drinking a New Belgian Fat Tire Ale.
Oh, well, there you go. See? Now, that could be a conversation all in itself. Like,
yeah.
For me, I truly do obsess over linguistics and people communicating back and forth. Like, I really hone in on that for the past couple of years, like, for some reason. But I think that, you know, I've told a lot of people that is at the heart of a lot of problems in design is people are communicating the way they believe they need to instead of just asking somebody, what would you like?
Mm-hmm.
What's the way that you would like to be communicated with? That honestly is a challenge for me. I'm looking at what's the biggest way that I can have an impact in getting people to see, you know, maybe holding yourself up in a room trying to solve a problem and you could have just walked outside and asked people
a
simple question.
Sure. Yeah. No, that's a good point. That's kind of goes to why I started the podcast. It was, you know, for me being holed up and, you know, I'm the lone designer in a fairly decent sized company and being pigeonholed and not being able to communicate with people because I kept trying to figure out what the solution was without knowing, you know, being able to identify what the problem was and,
yeah.
you know, I needed an outlet to kind of rewire my brain on how to work with it. And this was my way of doing that, was to talk with other people and get out of my comfort
this
zone.
This is awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I've heard quite a few of the interviews. They're cool. They're very cool. It's different. I think that, you know, even when I talk with people, I try to talk about my failures and mm-hmm. depression. Like, I really focus on that a lot, you know. Mm-hmm. The things that I've done wrong in my life, or the things that have gone wrong, to be honest right. with you, that, you know, only so long you can put things are great on Twitter and Facebook and all that stuff. It's, you know, I would rather people know the real me of, hey, you know, I'm just like you. I struggle with anxiety and depression and mm-hmm. right, trying to make the best of this world that we have in front of us, and still trying to create some fantastic branded products.
Perfect. I think that's a great way to wrap it up. So where can people find you online?
You can find me at said Funches. I'm usually tweeting out funny GIFs or something funny about sports. I try rarely to take myself seriously online. So at said Funches. I don't do Instagram too mm-hmm. much. I may start trying to take more pictures. I'm not good at it yet. So same thing at said Funches, CEDFUNCHES. Twitter's probably the best spot. Actually, it's said Funches on everything. CEDFUNCHES, LinkedIn, Facebook. Kept it very simple. But yeah, I reply to anyone who reaches out, and I've been truly fortunate, you know, getting a couple of my articles out there has opened the door for a lot of people to ask questions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's really been rewarding to talk to a lot of people who really look up to somebody like me, you know, a person of color who's done a lot and doesn't mind talking and helping individuals get to wherever they want to go. I mean, mm-hmm. doesn't hurt me. I'll help you until my last. I don't, like, you know, unless you're trying to get my job or something. But even if you're trying to get my job, I'd be like, that's kind of awesome. Sweet. What can I do to help you?
That takes, you know, some balls.
It really does. And I think a lot of designers, to be honest with you, Jason, mm-hmm. a lot of designers are shocked. That's what a lot of designers tell me. But like, yeah. Most designers at a certain level don't even do it. They don't have conversations. They don't talk. It's just like, whatever. I'm like, how are we going to teach younger designers how to do anything unless we're talking to one another? And so I've gotten some great cards in the mail, and, you know, designers are like, hey, thanks for talking. Like, most people don't even take the time. And I'm like, well, I'm going to. So I've kind of made it my mission. If you reach out, you know, a lot of people have, you reach out with an email, I'll respond. And if I can help you, I will. If I can advise you, I will. If I can point you in the right direction, I will. That's the least that I could do.
It's a good way to look at it. Good way to approach it.
Right on.
Cool.
This has been awesome, man.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. So we wrap up every podcast by saying, go out and hug some necks. And I know you've been to Creative South before. And this will go up the week after Creative South. But you'll be back again this year, and I'm sure your talk went awesome.
That's right. That's great. This is awesome. This is perfect. Yeah, we should talk post Creative South. Like, we should have just like one exchange, and I'm like, man, I know the barbecue was just amazing. Cool part about it, I'm bringing my wife. You're going to Creative South, right?
Yeah, I'm bringing my wife as well. My wife's a designer as well.
Bringing my wife? Yeah, awesome. I'm bringing my wife. My wife, I went to, I don't know if it was probably the second Creative South. I think mm-hmm. I was a speaker at the second Creative South. So ever since then, Mike has been like, man, you got to get down here. You got to see it's growing. It's just huge now. And so my wife actually looked at the website and she was like, oh, hell no, I'm going to this one. And so I'm bringing my wife and my son. And so I've got some pretty cool things planned on what I'll talk about. But, you know, it'll be more along the lines of positivity and, you know, how can we help individuals and what's our best way to get the best work done. And I will definitely be giving people hugs.
Awesome. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing you there.
Right on, man. Thank you so much for this. This is always great. And anytime that I can tell people that I was homeless and my wife helped me get out of my depression, a lot of people don't hear that. They hear that I recovered and I got better. I wouldn't have gotten any better unless it was for my wife. She's the one who really stuck with me. And
she's a keeper.
Me out of that. She is the keeper.
All right. Perfect.
Right.
Thanks
on.
Thanks again. All right.
Not a problem, man. Thank you.
Thank you. You can find out more about Sed on Twitter at Sed Funches, and be sure to check out the links in the show notes for more ways to keep up with him. You can keep up with the podcast on Twitter and Facebook at Creative SO Pod, and follow Creative South on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Creative South GA, over at creativesouth.com. And I'm at Jay Frostholm on Dribbble, Twitter, and Instagram.
For a limited time, new Skillshare customers can get their first 3 months for just 99 cents to get unlimited access to thousands of classes when you sign up at Skillshare.com using promo code Creative South. What are you waiting for? Start learning today. And remember, if you like the show, help support us over at patreon.com/creativesouth. And if you like the Creative South podcast, head over to iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. Rate us and leave a review. This helps more people find the podcast and allows us to keep getting awesome guests. Now go out and hug some necks.